The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. And I'm rushing to get started because my next guest is super busy. It is Tuesday. It is 4:40. It is a gorgeous day here in Toronto. The patio is packed. The back patio where I'm right now is going to be busy. I am at the Oxley Public House in Yorkville with the executive chef and the owner. It is Andrew Carter. Andrew, thanks so much for being part of the pod today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I am a huge fan of this place. I've been coming here for, I'd say, almost close to a decade.
Is that right? And this is the first time we've met, eh?
I know. It is the first time. The duck, the lamb burgers, the wine selection. The first time I ever had a bottle of white decanted, Jules Garten's idea, was here. So I just want to say first that I'm a huge fan of everything that you do here at the Oxley.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Matt. Thank you.
So what is this time now like for you, the sort of calm before the storm?
Well, it's crazy. So I've just sat down. I've got a cup of tea in my hand. It's 4:30, like you said. I was here at 7:30 this morning cleaning the patios. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's patio season. We wanted to get the patios open, as we usually do around May 2, 4. We have three patios, the one you walk through on, which gets the sun in the evening, which is beautiful. The one we're sat in the back, it's the courtyard. It's secluded. You're kind of in the city, but you're not in the city. And then we have the rooftop patio as well. So we have about 110 seats out here. So to get this place ready after the winter is, it's a big job. So.
And today actually was the first really sunny day. This is May 14th. The pod will be out in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about your new menu. But like the weekend was rainy. The weekend was shit.
Yeah, it's funny. Like we're in Toronto. So, you know, we've got to have a patio because if there's a glimmer of hope out there, people want to get on the patio. So.
No, what I mean is by that is this is the first. This feels like one of the first true patio days.
Right.
Which must have meant why you were so busy.
Yeah. And like I said, we open up May 2-4 because we've been here 13, 14 years now. So we know the pattern. We know what happens. People are longing to get out onto the patio. But we open them any earlier, the staff get a little ticked off and it's like, well, it's raining, we got to reset and all this kind of thing. So we've just figured it out. It's May 2-4. That's when we got to get them open for. So that's what we do.
That's an interesting balance for you because commerce versus also keeping your staff happy, because when the patio opens, if you're a little bit short staffed, that's a lot more running around for the people here.
It is. It's a gear change as well for the staff, especially for the front of house staff, because they've got to work outside of the user environment into a different environment, so they've got to get used to that flow as well. In a restaurant, it's all about flow. It's about down to the minute. I don't think people understand restaurants that way, but like when I put a piece of fish in the pan, I know when it's going to hit the table, so that I know what I'm thinking. So everything's got to run that way. So, you know, these few extra strides to get out onto the patio and to find your table and all the rest of it, it's kind of chaos.
So you and I are very similar. You're a time freak, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Are you the sort of person that if you lived in a condo, you would tie or untie your shoes in the elevator because that would save you 14 seconds of time?
God willing, I never live in a condo.
Because I live in a small apartment. I do that. I brush my teeth in the shower. I do everything to save every second. And because my normal job is radio, where everything starts and ends on a time, I know the difference between 48 seconds and a minute 25.
Yeah, it is. So the way that I think, you know, we have to get food on the table in a certain amount of time, because you as a customer coming in here, as soon as they order the food, your mental clock, whether you know it or not, has started clicking. And so as a chef, chef and a business owner, because one thing I've got to do is I've got to make sure you have a fabulous time when you come to the Oxley. I've got to make sure that we get the right food to the right table. It's the highest quality. We get all the beverages you want, the wine, the works, and we get you out the door so we can get more people in. Mm-hmm. And it's done in a way, it's a dance for us. For the customer, it should be seamless. They should not feel like they're being rushed out. They should not be poked at 1 hour and 30 minutes, we need your table back. We shouldn't be doing that. In my opinion, that's not hospitality. You know, we have constraints. It's also like a game of Tetris as well. So, you know, we may have your table booked in an hour and a half, but I've got another 60 tables here. So I'm going to be able to find another table that that's not going to disturb you. So it's a game of time in Tetris. It is kind of freaky when you start talking about it.
The key to Tetris is you got to try to get the one long line and get the four rows. That's where you get the bonus points.
Yeah.
I want to go back a second ago because you said you were here at 7:30 in the morning. By the way, I do have all these prepared questions. We'll get to them. You were here at 7:30 in the morning cleaning the patio. But Andrew, you're the owner and you're the chef. So you live this more la-di-da fancy life.
I would like to. No. It's funny. You know, the restaurant world is seen as very glamorous. For me, it's a beautiful industry. I love the restaurant industry. I love the hospitality industry, I have to say. And there's only three reasons you're in the restaurant. You either love it, you have too much money, or you're stupid. Those are the only reasons you're in it. I love it. So, yes, I was here at 7:30. Yes, I was scrubbing down the patios. I went home this afternoon. I grabbed a bite to eat. I got 15 minutes sleep. I came back in. I'm doing service tonight. I'm cooking tonight. So I'll close the kitchen tonight at 10 o'clock. So it's a day. And that's going to happen again tomorrow. And it's going to happen the next day. And it happened the next day. And so, you know, it's either a 6 day week. Sometimes I get a 5 day week. So it's kind of, you know.
Also, that's a tough commute. I know where you live. To get from here to where you live, that's especially now, that's a tough drive.
You know what? You find the routes. So Rosedale Valley Road is great. So yeah. You whip up there, I can be here in 15 minutes. So it's not too bad.
I think that might be more remarkable than your duck, if you can do that. All right, let's go back to your childhood for a second. I was reading all the articles I could. You said, quote, I quite literally grew up on the butcher's block. Your years as a child, how much did that lead to you being here right now?
Well, it's funny. I often think about it because, you know, we always, you know, we get to a certain age and we look back on our life and go, how we got here? What caused us to do this? You know, was it a butterfly wing or was it a sledgehammer to the side of the head? Or was it, you know, who knows what the heck it was? But I look back on it and my grandfather and father were butchers. You know, when I say I grew up on the block, it was literally on the butcher's block because my grandfather and my father, we had two businesses at that time. My father took them over and, you know, for me going down to the market, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning to go and help my dad scrape bones or mince whatever we had to do for pet, you know, all those menial jobs that a kid could do there, I was doing that. And so that was kind of my first venture into the food industry. And it was a real thing because I come from a little market town called Bury. Bury is in northwest of England, just outside of Manchester. In England, it's a very well-renowned market town. People come from all over England to go to Bury because it has this great market. I didn't know that as a kid. It was just a market. But at the market, when I was there, all the local purveyors were there, the cheese, the Bury black puddings, you know, the beef, the lamb. It was all local. Like, I used to go to the butcher's, to the abattoir, sorry, with my father and pick out sides of beef that we'd bring back and we'd break down. And so it was an intimate thing, but it was just life. It just what it was.
What was the grossest job you had to do before the age of 10?
So, and I know this without a heartbeat, it was we used to produce pet mints. And the pet mints sounds all, you know, very nice and good because you go to the pet stores now and you see all this mint and it looks like you can eat it. Well, this stuff, it was actually ground pluck. So pluck, if you don't know what pluck is the esophagus and the lungs of an animal. So we'd just mince that stuff and then we'd sell it in bags. It was disgusting. It'd come out. But when you cooked it, because it's basically a protein, it would firm up and the animals would eat it. So nothing used to get wasted.
Wow. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey, culinary school, and working for some pretty prestigious places before you were 25.
Yeah, I have, which I was very lucky to do. I had a great foundation, though. When I was at school, I got a job from a family friend who had an outside catering place. And so they used to do like sportsmen's dinners and things like that. So we'd get 200 guys in a room. We'd give them a three-course dinner. We'd have a sportsman do a presentation. We'd have a comedian do a presentation. It was a great night. I was 15 years old, and I was waiting tables. So I would get picked up at school or after school at probably 4:30, 5 o'clock. I wouldn't get home till 11:30, 12 o'clock at night because we'd travel to all these locations. So I'd be working three or four nights a week there. And for a night's work, I'd get paid £10. £10 for a night's work. and also as many beers as I could drink at 15, 16. And it doesn't, it sounds bad, but it wasn't.
No.
This family, it was a family-run business, and they took me under their wings, and they really looked after me. And it was a great foundation. These were really hardworking, honest people, and it was a great foundation for me. So I worked for them through school, and then when I was going through school, I wasn't really good at school, and it actually transpired later on in life that I had dyslexia. So math, English, all those kind of things were really hard for me. One thing I could do was cook. My home economics teacher was this little Irish woman. She was like 4 foot nothing, but just a little pit bull kind of thing. And she took me and she said, look, if you don't do your coursework, you're never going to get into college and all this kind of thing. So it was down to her and only her, because my parents were kind of doing their own thing, that I got into catering college, a couple of years in catering college. At the end of catering college, my lecturer, who we're still in contact to this day, which is wild, he said, there's a great opportunity down in London. And I said, okay, I'll take it. So I went down, got an interview, went in, and I ended up working for a guy, a chef called Nicola Dennis. Nicola Dennis, a 3 Michelin star chef, you know, he was at the top of his game. So the people who have come out of Nico's kitchens are people like Michael P.R. White, Gordon Ramsay, all the names that you know came out of there. There was a real scene back then. So I did a couple of years down in London, which was great. Prior to that, when I was actually at school, I got the opportunity to go to Switzerland when I was about 16, 17, and work for a chef in Switzerland. And that was my first exposure to fine dining. So the point where I went into the restaurant, I was like, I think I'm in too deep. This is crazy. Because all the chefs, they spoke French or German, and I only spoke English. So nobody could communicate. So it was a baptism of fire. So now when I go into a French kitchen, I know what's going on. Even though I don't speak French, I can speak kitchen French. I can understand the flow of the kitchen and all the rest of it. I can definitely swear in French. That's not a problem either. Yeah, that was a real baptism of fire over in Switzerland for it was like a kind of a summer. After Nico, I was working for another guy called Eric Chavot, who got a Michelin star. And so it was kind of a scene.
By the way, when you talked about your earlier days, 15, 16, making 10 pounds and serving these tables, working, you know, late at night, 3 nights, and all the beer you can have, I looked at that as you got to grow up. You got to mature quicker than a lot of people at your age at that time. So I kind of view it differently. All these steps, Andrew, were you usually the youngest person in the room?
Back then, not necessarily the youngest person, but you know, you say grow up. You like we've all got our stories. I was very lucky in my life. I look at some people today, and I see people on the street, and I go, you know, man, we're only 2 steps away from being on the street.
Yeah.
There's something happened in that person's life that's brought them to the street. I don't know what it is, but I know they were normal at one point. Just like I was normal. So my upbringing, you know, you can paint this picture that, you know, I had a hard life and all the rest of it, but it was my life. You know, I didn't get abused. I wasn't, it was a good life.
Sounds like it.
And I got a great training, and I learned a lot of things. You know, I wasn't book smart, but I was street smart. And I am still to this day. Like, I learned so much from those guys, the family and the respect for one another, for working hard and working as hard as you can, not just doing enough, but being exhausted at the end of it, because you knew you were going to be respected, not necessarily monetarily, but here, have a pint. Thanks very much for the hard push today.
The dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
How did that, you could cook, but how did that impact you in terms of like reading recipes or things? Was there any impact of that at all?
It's funny, recipes, I suppose, and I haven't really thought about this. It's a great question, because recipes were never really written down or used. Like, you know, we'd follow the chef. You just follow his recipe, and then you get a feel for it. Now, I put a recipe together, and the guys go, well, what's the recipe? And I go, okay, give me the beer mat, and I'll write it down for you. You know, because it's just a feeling, like how much of this, how much of that, how much of that. It's not like, you know, pastry where it's a science, it's a chemistry. But again, there's a lot of cookery now that it is a science. You know, you go to some beautiful restaurants, and it is, you know, the gastronomy, the molecular gastronomy, it's all down to a gram of this or a gram of that, which is not my jam. Right. I don't like that kind of stuff. I like the feel of it. Like, I remember when I was in, I did an exchange actually when I was at college with a French college. They were doing a gala dinner, and we were coming from the northwest of England, so we were nobody going into a French college. Like, we were kids, and they were looking down on us and all the rest of it. And it was a beautiful French college. You know, these guys were training to be chefs. You know, one of the guy I got paired up with, he's got a Michelin star now in Bordeaux, and he's doing his thing. But I remember there was like 14 chefs around this table, and they're all talking French, and they're loud, and I'm looking at these guys all with the hats on and the whites, and we didn't have whites. That's how removed we were. They were like, and like, I went over, and like, I was inquisitive. I was like, well, what's going on, guys? And they had this dish in front of me, and it was a seafood dish with a puff pastry over the top. I remember it vividly. This is, you know, 30 odd years ago, and they're all like, they were trying to figure it out, and I just took a spoon, tasted it, and I said, it needs salt, guys. And they were like, and they tasted it, went, yes, right, it needs salt.
Yeah.
And that was it. So, you know, the measuring and all that kind of thing, it in cookery, you don't need that.
Yeah.
It's a vibe, it's feel, it's sexy if you get down to it.
The cool thing there is, yeah, you don't need to be able to read Ulysses and break it down.
No.
You need to be able to read the room and go with your feel and your experience.
Yeah.
So I saw this quote, all the shouting and abuse you hear about happening in the kitchens in the 90s, it's all true. It was definitely formative. It taught me how not to run things. But I have to ask, the kitchen, in its essence, is a place of creativity. The goal is to feed, nourish, comfort the customers. And yet behind the doors, there's so much yelling going on. I'm curious, is it just because of the time and pressure involved?
It's many different things. So, you know, we can all be in pressure situations. I love F1. I don't know if you follow F1. Mm-hmm. Like, they take everything to the nth degree. It's beautiful what they do. You know, they're under a tremendous pressure. You know, it rains and then the strategy changes from A to B to C to whatever it is. They're under tremendous pressure, and their losses are multi-million dollars. You lose a couple of places, they're losing millions of dollars. So there's a massive pressure there, but you never see anybody shouting and screaming. You know, Toto may throw his headset now and again, but, you know, that's one of a thing. In kitchens is, it's a hodgepodge of people in there. You know, you've got those people who love and want to be chefs. You have those people who want to earn some money. You have those people who don't really know what they're doing, but they've got a job and it pays okay. And so you have a whole, you know, it's a really dysfunctional orchestra that's in there.
In a small square footage area.
Yeah. In the kitchen, you know, I, as the head chef, executive chef, when I'm leading the line, I lead the line. I drag people along. If I'm cooking or if I'm not cooking, if I'm expoing, and expediting is making sure the tables are going all together and that kind of thing. When I'm expediting, I don't know if anybody else does this, but I do this. I'm cooking with the guys. So if my saute guy is there, I'll say, take the chicken out, do this, do this, do this, do this. And I know the timing, and then I'm talking to the next guy, and then the next guy to make sure the table comes together that I can then send it. But what happens is, in the moment, there's people who don't necessarily understand that environment. And it gets to a point at times where you have to make a correction. But you have to tell somebody, you know what, get off the line. Mm-hmm. Or you have to correct the whole line. You know, we can do 500 people here at the Oxley, and we have three guys cooking on the line. That's
crazy.
It is crazy. It's crazy. And like, we could probably get one more on the line, but it's just the size of the line doesn't allow us to do it. When we're rocking, it's phenomenal. But I've had times where the kitchen has gone into, we have a term, you're in the shit. Like, you're in the shit. It's a, you know, it's a term that the wheels have fallen off everything. So I've dragged them all off the line in the middle of service. Chits are still coming on. I've taken them into the back. I've reamed them out. Guys, you got to get your shit together here. You know how to do this, but it's a correction. It's a shock. You have to shock people into it. When I went through the kitchens in London, it was abusive. It was formative. I learned a lot. Was it necessary? I would say yes. But when you're screamed at in the face to take a hot pan out of the oven, but you don't have a cloth, but you still have to take the pan out of the oven, that's a line that's been crossed.
Yeah. Did you have to do that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How was your hand the next day?
It was okay. I was fast.
Okay. Okay. Follow up to that. How hard is it for people not to take it personal? Because when you're doing it, when you're shocking the system, it's about teaching. We got to get this done. It's not, I don't like you, or I don't think you're intelligent, or I don't respect you. But I imagine that must be difficult, because My girlfriend calls me sometimes an emotional psycho because I take almost nothing personally.
Okay.
I'm very good at that. But that can be a hard thing for people. How hard is that for you?
I don't take things personally. I was always taught to do right by somebody. So even in my, you know, in an angry state, I'm doing right by them. I'm correcting them. They may come to understand that 5 years down the line and go, oh, you know, when, you know, Carter reamed me out, it was for this reason. You know, and but it's hard for young guys in the kitchen because I think we're living in a, you know, I don't want to get into it, but we're living in a world that's changed a lot. And when I came over to Canada, even coming over to Canada, 25 years ago, I had to learn how to speak differently to Canadian guys because I was too direct.
Right.
You know, please and thank you and all that kind of thing. Well, we don't have time for that in London. If you've ever been to London, you know people who live and work in London because they walk quicker than everybody else. It's as simple as that. We just go quicker. And so it's the same in the kitchen. Like, you know, I'm 50 odd years old and I'm going faster than anybody else in the kitchen. And so, you know, if I don't mind people, if they're slower than me, if they're trying the best, if you're giving me your all, great. If you're fucking the dog, I'm sorry. You're going to get it in the neck. You know, this isn't going to work.
Yeah. Also, I think it's not this whole thing. Oh, you know, this generation's more sensitive or this generation's harder. I think a lot of it is that years and years and years of marketing of Nike, you know, you're number one, or there's all the a lot of slogans and advertising. When you get that bombarded with you over the years about how wonderful you are, everyone's self-esteem rises, which is a good thing. Sometimes we have almost a little too much self-esteem, and sometimes we need to get it knocked down a bit. But it's hard to convey that without people thinking, oh, you just think that this generation is soft. I'm like, no, I don't. I just think every generation is a product of what's around them. And when I was growing up in the early 80s, there wasn't just do it. You're special. You're the best. There was far less of that in 1982 than what there was in 1998.
Sure, yeah. And I think also to be an athlete, to be a world-class athlete, you've got to have a massive ego.
Yes.
That's the extra 5% that nobody else have. It's the ego. And it's the same for being a chef. Like, I don't class myself as a chef. I'm an executive chef of a business because I'm in the kitchen, all the rest of it. But a chef, capital C, these world leaders like Marco Pierre White was in his time and those kind of guys, those were chefs. Like, he was so intense because he needed to be to do what he was doing. And so, you know, that intensity, it comes out in different ways. And the product is different as well. I wouldn't put my name up against other chefs. I'm a really good cook and I love what I do.
We're going to get back into your journey, but let's talk a little bit about the Oxley. What do people need to know if they haven't been here before? The new menu's coming up. Just, it's funny. I think so many of the interviews I do are usually with winemakers that I enjoy their wine.
Yes.
So if I'm going to talk to a chef and a restaurant owner, it might as well be at a place that I enjoy.
Well, the Oxley's been around, 13 years now. We opened up in Yorkville, great neighborhood. Well, it was a neighborhood. It was funny because when we first started talking about Yorkville, Toronto has a really jaded opinion about Yorkville.
Yes.
But that jaded opinion, there's a lot of truth in it as well, because all the things that people say about it are here. But there's a lot of things that people don't know are here. So the neighborhood is a beautiful neighborhood, a lot of well-traveled, successful people here. We have a good neighborhood. We have people who work in the neighborhood in some of the great businesses around here, and we have tourism that comes in here as well. You know, I can talk to anybody in Toronto, whether it's in Kensington Market, and they go, well, no, we've never been to Yorkville. You know, it is that divide in Toronto. But Yorkville is a beautiful neighborhood. The people who are around here, I've come to love, and, you know, many of them are friends now. But our customer base here at the Oxley is interesting because, you know, we have other establishments around here that attract a younger crowd, a clubby crowd, and that kind of thing. Whereas you walk in here, you know, you're going to see the bastions of business from Bay Street in here because they live up the road. You're going to see politicians in here. You're going to see entertainers in here, you know, because you've got One Hazelton across the road. You've got the Four Seasons up the road as well. So you've got people who are international travelers or maybe sports people or entertainers who are staying in the hotels, and they'll end up here because we're this... We are, in all intents and purposes, a British pub. And people come in and go, this is England. And it is. One of the things about the core of this, you know, you go to many establishments in Toronto and they're serving a 16-ounce pint. I'm an Englishman. I can't look you in the face and give you a 16-ounce pint because it's not a pint. 20 ounces is a pint. But I'm charging the same as a 16-ounce pint down the road. But the core of me, I'm English. And so I have to serve you a 20-ounce pint. When you come to the Oxley, you're going to come in and it's going to feel very familiar because this style of pub has been around for many, many years. Your grandparents, your parents, and even yourselves have probably been into a pub. If you've traveled to Europe or England, you've seen this before. So it gets very familiar. So what happens then is people get comfortable real easy. So they settle in. It's not like a fine dining restaurant where everybody gets stiff and everybody's like, oh, you got it. No, relax. A lot of good business gets done here because it's a nice, relaxed environment. When you come in, you're going to get top quality service. Our servers, we hound them to make sure that they're giving the best service. And one of the reasons being is, I know the difference. I grew up in fine dining. So when I see somebody carrying a scrunched up napkin through the dining room, I go, well, there's a better way of doing that. That's hold it by the corner. That's let it flow. It's a beautiful piece of linen that, you know, that's make it look good. So you're always going to be looking. I'm always looking to how can we improve it, even though we're a pub. We're a gastro pub, but we're a pub. I'm always looking to do the best that we can. The food is phenomenal. Anything on the menu, apart from the oysters, I want to eat because I'm not particularly a fan of oysters, and I'm also allergic. But
that make it tough.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. But the food is always fantastic, made from scratch. There's always lots of different proteins, and that's probably from my background. So I remember one year we counted up, we had 14 different proteins on the menu. So, you know, from guinea fowl to quail to chicken to salmon, sea bass to venison, whatever, lamb. You know, we always have a wide variety of things. We have two different menus on. Actually, we have three different menus, including the brunch menu. So we have a lunch menu. We have a dinner menu. The lunch menu also doubles as a bar menu. So you have the things like beautiful fish and chips, hand-chopped burger, which, you know, I did back in the day. And it's not your usual burger. The question I get my service to ask is, have you ever had our burger before? Because if you haven't, you're probably not going to like it if you don't know what it is. So we have to tell you what it is because it's not a burger. It's a hand-chopped piece of beef that we enrich with marrow and seasonings, and then we can cook it any color you want. It's topped off with our own house-smoked bacon, aged cheddar on one of our own buns. So it's people saying, oh, you've got to put a burger on. I didn't want to put a burger on because I was kind of like, I was in my own little world, but I was like, okay, if I'm going to do a burger, I'm going to do this burger. So that's what we did. And then you get to the dinner menu, a little bit more elevated. You know, you spoke about the duck. We have a nice sable fish on right now with a bisque risotto. So we've got something for everything. I've just put a chicken dish on that people are going nuts for right now. It's so I call it a brick chicken. So the old Italian way of putting a brick on top of a chicken to cook it. But I debone the chicken so it cooks flat. And then I put that on top of a celeriac puree with some of fresh Ontario asparagus, some artichokes, some tarragon, and some Madeira Jew. And it's flying out the door. And it's $29. And people say, well, your prices are too cheap. I'm sounding like Tom at Tom's Place right now.
By the way, that is a great reference. 7% of the podcast is going to get that. Hey, Tom from Tom's Place. Yes. And no one else is going to get that.
But, it's $29. And people say, well, why don't you charge more? And I said, well, it's a piece of chicken. What can I do with a piece of chicken that's making it worth more than $30? I can't. Yeah. That's kind of an ethos of me as well. I don't want to, I can't take money off you if it's not worth it. So that's why our prices are kind of low. And when I say low, the where prices should be.
Yes.
And what happens when the prices are where they should be, the quality is good, the service is good, we're busy. So we're open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner and brunch. And I'll get onto the brunch menu because that's just changed up as well. But we don't close. We're, you know, even after lunch service, we're open. You can get bar snacks here.
Even so, like the dead zone? Like it's
the dead zone's our busy zone because everybody's closed.
2:45 p.m. You got people here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We'll get to brunch one second, but you mentioned this is a British pub. And one way I know this is a British pub, You guys have a wide variety, at least last time I was here, by the glass of, as you would call it, claret, as the rest of the world would call it, Bordeaux.
Yes.
It seems like you got lots of Bordeaux here.
Yeah, we've got a great list. Thanks to Jules, my wife. She works with us to get the list together. And she used to work for me years ago, and she took over the list then. So it's kind of her baby. I'm not quite sure how many labels we've got on site, but I know we've got a depth there that will hit every wine drinker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking about this before you were coming in, Matt, and I know you it's a wine blog and a wine podcast, but the majority of our sales on wine is by the glass. We have people just coming in and just want a glass of red, just want a glass of white, and that's where they go. I would say that's probably about 75% of our marketplace.
Which actually I wanted to get to. It's one of the reasons is that this wasn't going to be a podcast about acidity or winter pruning or...
Good, because I can't answer those questions.
You know, we'll save that for later, you know, and get your thoughts on English Pinot Noir. There is some damn Limey Bay. There's some damn good British Pinot Noir. What that says about climate change, we'll save for another podcast. How important is the Buy the Glass program for a lot of restaurants in terms of just the economics behind it?
You know, I'm feeling my wife looking at me now because what I'm going to say goes against, and it doesn't go against it because Jules is in a different realm. You know, Jules is selling some beautiful wine, some wine that I wouldn't spend the money on. I couldn't even appreciate. It's like me getting onto a carbon fiber bike.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know the difference. I have no idea. You know, only that it's more expensive. You know, our Buy the Glass program is our driving point of wine. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
It is what everybody wants. They come in, they want either a 6 or an 8 ounce, and away you go.
But I think that's the case for so many restaurants. I mean, you know, things like where Don Alfonso or Bovine or Blue Blood, like these incredible restaurants, I go there for the bottles.
Sure.
I'm not going to be at Casaloma. I mean, I'll get a glass of white while the res decanting. But for like restaurants like this, and even like ones like slightly higher end or a little lower end, from everything that I've learned over the years, is that the Buy the Glass program, the Wine Buy the Glass program, is so important for restaurants in terms of their bottom line, where, you know, it's hard to make a profit for a lot of restaurants.
It is. The Buy the Glass is important, period. You know, wine prices have gone up. So, and also, you know, people are being more cautious about where they're spending the wine as well. So to go out and buy a bottle of wine, whether it's $200-$400, you know, and then you think about putting 20% on top of that for your tip, it's too much money for a bottle of wine in my unless I really wanted to drink that bottle of wine.
Yeah.
You know, but if I'm out with Jules, you know, we're drinking whatever she sees is interesting, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an expensive bottle. It's like, oh, I've never had this producer. I want to try this, you know, so it's fun going out drinking with Jules, having wine. When it comes to the restaurant here, like I said, we've got a deep list. There's
you
something
do.
Here for everybody. We have some beautiful wines. We have some nice aged wines as well. It, again, you know, it's what we like to drink. You know, we're not buying the Camus, you know, even though we would sell it. I'm not buying Camus.
By the way, good for you. And not to get wine snobby, and there's a place for Camus and big California reds, but I love the fact that that doesn't fit here. This, it does fit for Yorkville, for there's a lot of the bastions of Bay Street that would love it. I like the fact that, to thine own self be true, if we're going to go a little Shakespeare, that you're sticking with the wines that you like that fit with this menu.
Yeah, and we've got some big wines, and we've got some big Californian wines.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody buys Camus. It's $200 a bottle. Everybody's selling it for $480 maybe. It's too much money. You know, and then you're tipping on top of that. I'm sorry, it's ridiculous. I would rather have... I spent some time down in Niagara with Thomas Batchandler, you know, and the guy is like, he's an oracle of wine from, you know, Niagara. And, you know, some of his wines are phenomenal.
He's been on the podcast many times. I've often said his wines, if he threw the word Burgundy on the bottle, yep, he could charge twice as much. People wouldn't know, they'd pay for it.
Yeah. And, you know, he has a challenge because it's Canadian. It's, you know,
yeah,
and people have that stigma, which probably popped up 20 years ago. But
we're doing our best to fight it.
Yeah, yeah. But it's... You know, it's brand recognition. You mentioned Nike before. You know, Camus is one of those labels. Oh, yeah, let's have a bottle of Camus. Let's have a bottle of Silver Oak. That's, well, you know, if you're drinking Silver Oak, you better have 20 years on it.
Yeah.
And if it's not, there's no point in drinking it.
The funny thing about this place is how everyone perceives it differently. As you said before, musicians, actors, business people, and everyone in between. I always viewed this place as, it was a good burger, but I would come here for duck, I would come here for lamb, and to try your wine list. Like that's how I view the Oxley, which is very different than the way I think a lot of other people view this place.
Yeah, and you know, some people know us for our wine. Some people know us for our cask ales, because we run three different engines on cask ales. Which
20-ounce pours.
20-ounce pours in a knobbly or a sleeve if you want. You know, we run I think we've got 7 taps of beer. We have, you know, we've just extended our non-alcoholic list as well, which it seems to be more important, because we're in a shift right now, and I've seen this in my industry, that the generation that are coming through are not drinking alcohol like they used to, not like our generation. So, you know, they want to come out, they want to have fun, but they may not want to drink. So we have to provide interesting things. And we see that with producers as well. In the beer world, not so much in the wine world, because I don't think we've got there in the wine world. I think there are some non-alcoholic wine, which, you know what?
There's some out there. There's tiny little oases of it.
Sure,
but
yeah.
That's where we're at with that.
But it's, you know, we've got some non-alcoholic drinks out there. We've got, like, the Phony Negronis and things like that, which people are loving. And
that's
quite frankly, the only reason they're on the menu, because I taste them, I go, yeah, I drink this.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's the royal stamp of approval, if you like. Like, if I like it, it's going on the menu.
What's the brunch menu like?
Brunch menu, it's got your classic. It's got the full English breakfast. The full English breakfast, and anything and everything apart from the Heinz tomato ketchup is made here. So, you know, the baked beans are made in-house. The sausages are made in-house. The bacon's made in-house. The bread that we fry in the fryer is made in-house. The tomatoes, we don't have a rooftop garden to grow them, but, the tomatoes are there. It's a great full English. It's an English full English. And then we have some light affair. So we have, like, I call it a frittata, which is basically like a pancake, very, very thin omelette. I call a frittata. So I put some seedlings on top of that. So it's nice, it's fine, and it's light. We have fresh fruits. We do a fruit board, which is beautiful. I've also got a dish that I've just brought back on, which is a kedgeree. So kedgeree it comes from the Raj era. So when the English were over in, it was actually the Scottish. So when the Scottish were over in India, they came up with this dish, which is a curried dish with, it's curried rice. Got smoked haddock in there. It's got a poached egg on it. It's finished off with some cilantro and some almonds. Beautiful dish. Very old, classic kind of thing. You know, if you in London, you go to some of the old Bastion restaurants, you'd find this on the menu. And so that's there, and it's selling well. We have a nice quiche. And the quiche isn't actually on the menu. We put it on as a special. But I say quiche because I'm a guy. This is a quiche that a guy would eat.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something your grandmother wants to eat. This is a quiche. It's a good quiche. So
you're leaving full.
You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
You're going to be fine.
What was the first year like for you? What was 2012? What was the first year like for you at the Oxley?
You know, when you open up a business, and, you know, over the years I've opened up a few businesses, it's hell. Absolute hell. You don't know if it's going to happen. You don't know if it's going to work. And it's like anything. I suppose sports are a little different, but arts, you paint a picture and you don't know if anybody's going to enjoy it. But the only way you're going to find out is put it in front of somebody. My old business partner and I, we opened up the Queen and Beaver down on Elm Street, just up from Barbarians.
Very nice man, by the way.
Yeah, Jamie's a great guy.
Yes, he is.
Great guy, and loves his wine. And so Jamie's running the Queen and Beaver right now. And when we opened up that place, you know, it was the same thing. We'd nailed it. We were doing a gastropub. We were doing the food this way. We had a great wine list and this kind of thing. And James Chaddo came in with his wife. And I'm chatting with James. And I didn't know it was James at the time until halfway through the conversation. And he said, Andrew, I love what you're doing, but I don't think Toronto are going to get this. Because it was an English gastropub. It was one of the first in Toronto. I think Cayley Cottage was in and around the same place back then.
I love Cayley Cottage.
Yeah, it's changed a lot now. I think
it's not what it was.
Patrick gone, and Patrick was kind of the glue of that place.
You guys must have not got along at all. He's the master shucker. He is the oyster king of Canada. I've known him and his children forever.
He's done well, and I see him now, and he's shucking oysters all over the place.
Yeah,
so
winning awards. And
That. But when we opened up the Queen and Beaver, it was the same thing. Is this going to work? And we didn't know, but it did. It took off, and then this place settled in, took off. But the first time, it's like, is this going to work? We don't know. You don't know until you try. So try.
How difficult are you at a restaurant that isn't yours? You're sitting there at the table. How awkward, uncomfortable is it, especially if the person you are with is not good at confrontation?
My wife, Jules, God bless her, hates dining out with me. She hates it. And I understand why. And I have no qualms with the hatred between going dining out with me, because I can't turn off. It could be a myriad of things. I look, you know, when I go into a place, I'm looking at how many staff are in the place and why do they have all these staff in here? And then I get the bill and I go, oh, that's why they've got all the staff in here, because they need, you know, it's the math of a restaurant is finite. It's, you know, we can only charge so much for something before people stop coming. And so when I go into a restaurant and, you know, I could have had a great meal, but then the bill comes and I go, well, that piece of protein you gave me was probably worth about $2.50 and you charged me $32 for it. I don't know why I'm paying you now, you know, and then I've got a tip on that as well. I'm terrible when I go and eat out. But on the odd moments that the wind's blowing in the right direction and the sun's setting and I have the right glass of wine, thanks to my wife, in my hand, I can have a really good time at times.
Do you guys ever argue about wine, or you just always acquiesce?
It's funny. No, we don't argue about wine because we have very similar tastes. And I've learned a lot from Jules. And Jules is, you know, if anybody knows Jules, they know she's a savant at what she does. Like,
yes.
You know, I get it. She does this gridding thing where she does a blind taste and she'll grid. It's a
quartermaster sommelier.
There you
grid.
Go.
Oh, yeah.
So she'll do the grid thing, but it's kind of my thing. I love it when she does it, and I can just sit there and listen to her do it. It's fantastic. But when it comes to wine, we have very similar tastes, and I engage to a certain level, probably about a quarter of a glass, and then I kind of turn off because it bores me after that. But, you know, I'll be saying, am I tasting this? And she'll go, yeah. And, you know, so with my palate and her palate, it's an interesting conversation. The wines we drink varied, like I say. You know, Jules has got some great wine friends and sommeliers around her as well, who come around and they're drinking some fabulous wines. You know, they're all trying to not necessarily one up themselves, but bring the unicorn into the room,
of course,
kind of thing.
It's,
so
it's competitive. You love doing that. There's nothing better than when you're at an event and everyone brings a bottle and goes, that was the best bottle.
Yeah,
it's a weird point of pride, but we all feel it.
But, you know, then there's times Jules she'll get excited. You know, we were at her mother and father's over the weekend because of Mother's Day. And she said, I'm going to bring these two Burgundies, a white and a red. And, you know, they're a good bottle. Like, spent some good money on it and all the rest of it. And it just come in. And I was like, all right, great. Because, you know, fantastic Burgundy. Like, who doesn't like a, you know, bottle of Burgundy? And I didn't like the wines, either of them. And I said, I don't know if I like this. She says, it's fine.
By the way, that will actually save you guys a lot of money if you wake up one day and decide Burgundy is not for you.
We've already established that Burgundy is for us.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. It's kind of for everyone.
Well, we were in Santa Barbara last week, actually, and we're drinking white Burgundy over there. It's like,
that's funny. Forget the forget Sonoma.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be on the Montrachet. All right, it's funny. I have some other questions, but I'm going to end this now because it's almost 5:30.
Sure.
You've got to work. Andrew, tell people listening again the address, websites. Just want you to promote this wonderful restaurant that, again, I've been coming to for years.
Okay, so the Oxley is at 121 Yorkville Avenue in Toronto. We are just opposite Hazelton Lanes. The website is theoxley.com. Pretty straightforward. Come by, drop in for a pint or a glass, come in for dinner. We're here. We're open 7 days a week. And and I say this to people, the Oxley is a business. Yeah, we're here to make money. But the Oxley is something I love. I love this place. So I hope if you do come, you do enjoy what I love. And please say hi.
Andrew, thank you so much. I know how busy you are. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Spotify, Apple, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.